You're listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.
A man who harassed six female writers and journalists by sending them hundreds of abusive messages over 6 years has been jailed for 3 years. Dublin Circuit Criminal Court heard that 37-year-old Brendan Doolan left his home only twice in the 17 years before his crimes were investigated. Judge Martin Nolan said his behaviour towards Sarah Griffin, Kate McAvoy, Sinead O'Carroll, Christine Bowen, Roe McDermott and Aoife Barry was gravely reprehensible because he persisted in communicating with them for so long despite repeated requests to stop. Roe McDermott said, "Every single time he sent a nasty message to me, every time he invoked my personal traumas to insult me, every single time he jeopardized my career by messaging my workplace, every time he risked damaging my personal reputation by messaging people in my life, I believe Brendan Doolan was trying to harass me into silence." The six women issued a joint statement. It's read here by one of them, Christine Bowen.
"Brendan Doolan's campaign of harassment against us went on for years. We hope that this case shows other men and women in this situation that what they say will be taken seriously if they come forward, and that online harassment is harassment and will be treated as such. We hope Brendan Doolan receives the help and rehabilitation that he needs. We'd like to thank Detective Garda Colm Gallagher and his colleagues at the Cybercrime Unit for their painstaking work on and a sensitive approach to this case."
Dr. Mary Aiken is a cyber psychologist and a honorary professor in the Department of Law and Criminology at the University of East London. Mary Aiken, good morning again. Thanks for taking our call.
Good morning.
Is this case unique?
I think it is. I think it's a major breakthrough. I think it's a step forward in the real world and a giant step forward in cyberspace. I think for the first time, you know, it's an example of consequences for these types of behavior online, these types of behavior in cyberspace. The point is that deterrence is the central principle, you know, in terms of any criminal justice system, and that works on the premise that the threat of punishment will deter people from committing crime and reduce the probability and level of offending in society. In this case, is now showing that there are consequences for the offender's behaviour, and hopefully going forward, deterrence as a principle will work.
The extent of contact from this man over many years to the women is extraordinary. Although, as I said, the judge said he was told he never left his house, only twice in 17 years, the women were made to feel that he was a constant and a threatening presence in their life for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, this case is a mixture of online harassment, of trolling, and of cyber stalking, and a toxic combination of all three, which could be terrifying for the victims.
If this sets a legal precedent here, what are the implications of this judgment going forward?
Well, it's very interesting, as it comes at a time whereby the government are looking at amendments to the Harassment, Harmful Communications and Related Offences Bill 2017. And in fact, the Joint Committee on Justice and Equality have just basically wrapped up their hearings. I actually testified on this matter last month to that committee. And it's going to raise, yes, an interesting legal precedent, but additionally, it's also going to raise the question of how are the Gardaí going to deal with these problems in terms of if online harassment or cyberbullying is criminalised. Because the problem is, essentially, these are big data problems. And that means sort of extremely large data sets in a cyber context. Let me give you an example. Facebook has 2.5 million users in Ireland. If on a Monday morning 10% of them got onto the Gardaí to complain, "I think I've been harassed or bullied online," that would be 250,000 complaints. If even 1% complained on a Monday morning, that would be 25,000 complaints. Our Gardaí are simply not resourced to deal with this sort of tsunami of complaints.
while this case is unique in terms of it having been followed through to conclusion, it's not unique in terms of the type of abuse that was involved. You tweeted yourself last night in response to this case, finally, consequences for trolling. Victims felt like they were under surveillance. I know that feeling. Can you tell us more?
Oh, certainly. You know, there's a cohort that operate online that as soon as you say something in an interview or write an article or appear on television, that they will jump in and attempt to troll you. But, you know, I'm a cyber behavioral scientist. I'm resilient. When you troll me, all you do is give me data and lots of it. But I'm very concerned about people who have less resilience and less coping skills. And if you read the impact statements of the victims in this question,
yes,
and let's remember, these were professional journalists, you know, used to robust engagement online, used to debate, used to defending their opinion, and they were traumatized by what happened. Now, let's imagine an 8 or 9 or 10 or 11-year-old child being the victim of such abuse without having the coping skills. That's the part that really, really worries me.
Mary, thank you for talking to us again. That's Dr. Mary Akin. She's a cyber psychologist and honorary professor in the Department of Law and Criminology at the University of East London. Dunleary TD Maria Bailey won't be a candidate for Fine Gael at the next general election. The decision was taken by the party's national executive last night after a recommendation by Fine Gael president and Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. Her position had been under pressure after revelations of a personal injury claim over a fall off a swing in a Dublin hotel emerged shortly before this year's local and European elections. We contacted Maria Bailey to ask her to talk to us this morning, but there was no response. We contacted Martin Hayden, the chairman of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party, and there was no response. Fine Gael press office replied to our requests by saying they were not putting anyone forward. Fine Gael Senator Michelle Mulhern on Virgin Media last night said she was disappointed for Maria Bailey.
I think the coverage of what has happened to her hasn't been proportionate or fair. This is going on since last May, and it has been incessant, the sort of coverage she's got, the abuse she's got. And I seriously wonder if she was a man, if she would have got it.
Let's talk now to our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham. Morning, Paul.
Good morning.
What happened last night?
Last night, the National Executive Council of Fine Gael met at its headquarters in Mount Street. The council is made up of Oireachtas members, councillors, ordinary party members, and also some party officials. They considered a recommendation from the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, and that stated that Maria Bailey should be removed from the Dunleary constituency ticket for the next general election, and that she should be replaced by a local councillor, Jennifer Carroll McNeill. What was a little bit different to the usual proceedings was that Maria Bailey was allowed to address the council. She's not a member of the NEC and therefore wouldn't have any rights, but she turned up at the building and was allowed to go in and address people, and she made her case. And after that, she left and the council continued with its business, and it decided to endorse what the Taoiseach had recommended as president of the party. And as you said, Maria Bailey is now no longer able to defend her seat in the upcoming general election.
Paul, do you know what she told the meeting or how she was received?
We know that she was received quietly, respectfully. She was able to make her case. But there wasn't any follow-up questions, there wasn't any brouhaha afterwards. She made her case, she left, the council continued and took its decision.
As Michelle Mulhern pointed out, this case has been very drawn out for Fine Gael and for Maria Bailey. Is it over now?
Well, I think Maria Bailey, in her statement, which was released just after 9 o'clock, and actually before the Fine Gael's own statement, she was pointing out to the fact that this had been a matter which she had believed had been concluded in July, that the Taoiseach had undertaken a report, and there had been an investigation. They'd arrived at a conclusion that she should stand down from the Oireachtas Housing Committee, and the Taoiseach had told her that the matter had been concluded. In her statement, Miss Bailey alludes to the fact that what she terms anonymous sources, however, within the party kept this going, and ultimately it led to a meeting of constituency members in Dunleary, and they said they called for an urgent review by the Executive Council of their general election ticket. And you can see from Miss Bailey's statement, she felt that the procedures which were adopted at that particular meeting, she had significant issues with. in stating that, that sort of leaves open or raises the question as to whether or not she wants to take any action on foot of what she believes to be a meeting which wasn't handled correctly. But certainly from Fine Gael's point of view, they are hoping that this will draw the line under the matter and that Ms Bailey is able to continue as a TD, she's able to continue in the Fine Gael parliamentary party. But after that, the party moves on with a new candidate and they hope that the story will die.
Procedures aside, why has Maria Bailey been dropped from the Fine Gael election ticket?
What's been clear from senior Fine Gael ministers for the past couple of weeks, ever since that meeting on Halloween by the Dunleary constituency members, was that it is the members of Fine Gael who select their candidates. And the fact that the members of Fine Gael had said that they were looking for an urgent review and effectively stating that they had lost confidence in Maria Bailey, that Fine Gael was acting on their desire. So that's what makes it different. It is accurate to say that the Taoiseach had dealt with it in July internally, but once you lose the support of your own members in the constituency, then the National Executive Council and the President of the party will adhere to what the members' wishes are. So that's the difference between the two timelines, between October 31st when the constituency members met and earlier in July when the Taoiseach sanctioned her.
Will she run again?
It's unclear. I thought that it was notable in her statement that she says that she is a proud member of Fine Gael, that she thanked the members of Fine Gael for her support, that she thanked the National Executive Council for allowing her to speak last night. It didn't strike me as someone who was outraged at her position and was going to head off and become an independent and stand for the people of Dunleary, feeling that she had been treated unfairly and therefore wanted to move forward. It sounded to me as if someone who was, as she said, you know, leaving the door open to remaining in Fine Gael, leaving the door open to a possible return. But she did say in her statement that she was reflecting on her position, so maybe it's just the case that she hasn't reached a decision.
Paul, do you know, does she remain in the Fine Gael parliamentary party between now and the election, whenever that is?
Yes, that's as I understand it. She remains a member of the Fine Gael parliamentary party for as long as that she wishes to. If it's the case that she wants to remove herself from that, that's a decision for her. But the party is not going to make any decision to exclude her. And that is a strange scenario in which she can remain a member of the parliamentary party, the same party which doesn't believe that she can stand and defend her seat.
Paul, thank you for that. That's our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham. A man who harassed six female writers and journalists by sending them hundreds of abusive messages over 6 years has been jailed for 3 years. Dublin Circuit Criminal Court heard that 37-year-old Brendan Doolan left his home only twice in the 17 years before his crimes were investigated. Judge Martin Nolan said his behaviour towards Sarah Griffin, Kate McAvoy, Sinead O'Carroll, Christine Bowen, Roe McDermott and Aoife Barry was gravely reprehensible because he persisted in communicating with them for so long despite repeated requests to stop. Roe McDermott said, "Every single time he sent a nasty message to me, every time he invoked my personal traumas to insult me, every single time he jeopardized my career by messaging my workplace, every time he risked damaging my personal reputation by messaging people in my life, I believe Brendan Doolan was trying to harass me into silence." The six women issued a joint statement. It's read here by one of them, Christine Bowen.
"Brendan Doolan's campaign of harassment against us went on for years. We hope that this case shows other men and women in this situation that what they say will be taken seriously if they come forward and that online harassment is harassment and will be treated as such. We hope Brendan Doolan receives the help and rehabilitation that he needs. We'd like to thank Detective Garda Colm Gallagher and his colleagues at the Cybercrime Unit for their painstaking work on and a sensitive approach to this case."
Dr. Mary Aiken is a cyber psychologist and a honorary professor in the Department of Law and Criminology at the University of East London. Mary Aiken, good morning again. Thanks for taking our call.
Good morning.
Is this case unique?
I think it is. I think it's a major breakthrough. I think it's a step forward in the real world and a giant step forward in cyberspace. I think for the first time, you know, it's an example of consequences for these types of behavior online, these types of behavior in cyberspace. The point is that deterrence is a central principle, you know, in terms of any criminal justice system, and that works on the premise that the threat of punishment will deter people from committing crime,
then reduce the probability and level of offending in society. And this case is now showing that there are consequences for the offender's behaviour, and hopefully going forward, deterrence as a principle will work.
The extent of contact from this man over many years to the women is extraordinary. Although, as I said, the judge said he was told he never left his house only twice in 17 years, the women were made to feel that he was a constant and a threatening presence in their life for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, this case is a mixture of online harassment, of trolling, and of cyber stalking. And a toxic combination of all three, which could be terrifying for the victims.
If this sets a legal precedent here, what are the implications of this judgment going forward?
Well, it's very interesting, as it comes at a time whereby the government are looking at amendments to the Harassment, Harmful Communications and Related Offences Bill 2017. And in fact, the Joint Committee on Justice and Equality have just basically wrapped up their hearings. I actually testified on this matter last month to that committee. And it's going to raise, yes, an interesting legal precedent, but additionally, it's also going to raise the question of how are the Gardaí going to deal with these problems in terms of if online harassment or cyberbullying is criminalised. Because the problem is, essentially, these are big data problems. And that means sort of extremely large data sets in a cyber context. Let me give you an example. Facebook has 2.5 million users in Ireland. If on a Monday morning, 10% of them got onto the Gardaí to complain, I think I've been harassed or bullied online, that would be 250,000 complaints. If even 1% complained on a Monday morning, that would be 25,000 complaints. Our Gardaí are simply not resourced to deal with this sort of tsunami of complaints.
While this case is unique in terms of it having been followed through to conclusion, it's not unique in terms of the type of abuse that was involved. You tweeted yourself last night in response to this case, finally consequences for trolling, victims felt like they were under surveillance. I know that feeling. Can you tell us more?
Oh, certainly. You know, there's a cohort that operate online that as soon as you say something in an interview or write an article or appear on television, that they will jump in and attempt to troll you. But, you know, I'm a cyber behavioral scientist. I'm resilient. When you troll me, all you do is give me data, lots of it. But I'm very concerned about people who have less resilience and less coping skills. And if you read the impact statements of the victims in this question,
yes,
and let's remember, these were professional journalists, you know, used to robust engagement online, used to debate, used to defending their opinion, and they were traumatized by what happened. Now let's imagine an 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 year old child being the victim of such abuse without having the coping skills. That's the part that really, really worries me.
Mary, thank you for talking to us again. That's Dr. Mary Aiken. She's a cyber psychologist and honorary professor in the Department of Law and Criminology at the University of East London.
8:15 here on Morning Ireland. We go straight to the breaking news this morning of three arrests in connection with the investigation into the abduction and attack on Quinn Industrial Holdings director Kevin Lunny. We can talk to our North East correspondent Sinead Hussey. Sinead, we know that the Gardaí and PSNI formed a joint investigation team to investigate this attack and other attacks on Quinn Industrial Holdings. We know there was that raid in the UK in which the chief suspect Cyril McGuinness collapsed and died. What can you tell us about this latest development?
Yes, Brian, this has been a very intense investigation, and we understand that there's been three arrests today, two men and a woman. Two are being held under Section 50 and another being held for withholding information. I understand they're being held at Cavan, at Kells and Monaghan the stations. We saw, as you said last week, these searches take place in Cavan, Longford, Dublin and in the UK. We saw the PSNI and the Gardaí form that joint investigative team, and they're looking at all of the attacks on Quinn Industrial Holdings directors. It's almost 2 months now since Kevin Dunne was attacked as he made his way home to Derry Lynn. Last week during that spotlight interview on BBC, we heard firsthand the violence, the extreme violence inflicted on him. And even since then, the Taoiseach has met with him and the other directors. So really, this is a very intense investigation. We expect further details on these arrests later, but certainly it's a significant development.
Very good. More from you, no doubt, Sinead, in the course of the day.
Today is World Prematurity Day. That's an occasion to celebrate babies that were born early and survived. Prematurity is when a baby is born before 37 weeks of pregnancy. Europe's busiest maternity hospital, the Rotunda in Dublin, is marking the day with a party for 70 people who were born early and their families, and we'll be talking to the hospital's master shortly. But first, our reporter Jill Steadman has visited the neonatal unit at the Rotunda, where she met Nicola Mullen from County Wexford. Nicola gave birth to twin girls, Maya and Macy, just 10 weeks ago at 24 weeks. Sadly, Macy, who had anencephaly, died shortly after birth. Nicola spoke to Jill about the care that Maya is receiving.
Well, Mia was born 15 weeks early, so far we've been here 10 weeks. We still have probably another 5 to go, maybe longer. Like, everything they go through, all the needles, the surgeries, everything, like, you just know nothing will ever prepare you for seeing a baby that small going through everything that she has, you know, like, it's so heartbreaking. At the start, her lungs were very, like, immature, so she was on the ventilator, which she was on for a really long while. When she was about 4 weeks old, she had to go to Our Lady's Hospital in Crumlin to have a duct closed on her heart. And that was very, very scary, but she came through it, and after, I think it was about 2 weeks after her procedure, she was able to come off the ventilator, and she's on CPAP now, which is really good because she's only on like a little bit of oxygen, so it's just like a little bit of extra help. It's hard kind of like travelling up every day. We live in Wexford now, so we travel up every day to see Mia, but we have another baby at home who's 20 months old, so we're trying to divide our time, which is also very hard. But hopefully she'll be home soon, and this will just be like a distant memory then.
And tell us about some of the challenges. You mentioned travelling from Wexford. What other challenges have you faced?
When she was first on the ventilator, you weren't able to get to hold her a lot, and her skin was very delicate when she was first born. So trying to bond with her was really hard in the first few weeks, but now it's just amazing getting to hold her and just see her change every day. Like, it's brilliant.
Yourself and Aaron seem to be coping quite well now. You have a good support network. Is that very important?
Oh, definitely. I don't know how we would have coped without my family and Aaron's family and friends, and everyone here has been amazing as well. Do you know, like, they're very good at explaining stuff to you when you need them to, and they've just, everyone's just been amazing, really. Like, I don't know how we would have done it without them.
Nicola, you were showing me some photos of Mia. One of them stood out. Will you tell us a little bit about that photo?
Okay, so basically it's Mia in her little superhero cape, and they have a group of Rotunda knitters who send around packs all the time. Actually, they have lovely blankets, little booties, cardigans and all, but obviously on Halloween they had little costumes, which was so cute to see when we came in with Mia in our costume. They're so nice. Every time you come in, I think once a month or something, there's new packs like for us with blankets and stuff, and they're just adorable, like little tiny hats and all, like...
And looking back on the photos, you can really see how much Mia has come on.
Yeah, she's grown so much, like from 1 pound 3 now to like 4 pounds. She is like such a big girl now. At the start, like, it was hard to see her coming home. Now we feel like we're able to plan for her coming home and stuff. Now we wouldn't have an exact date in your mind. You wouldn't want to get excited hoping that she's getting out on her due date, but we can see her coming home. But it would be so nice to have her home for Christmas. That's what everyone's praying for.
That's Nicola Mullen, mother of baby Mia, talking to Jill Steadman. The master of the Rotunda Hospital is Professor Fergal Malone. He's with us in our studio now. Fergal, thank you very much for coming into us this morning. Tell us about the type of care that premature babies require.
Premature babies need the highest possible level of medical care. They need one-on-one nursing support throughout their stay, and they need high-level medical care from experts in neonatology. There's significant risk of infection for premature babies, there's significant risk for immature lungs, significant risk of bleeding in the brain. So it really is the highest possible level of care to protect our future citizens.
Why are babies born prematurely?
In many cases, we don't know. A woman comes in with preterm labour or rupture of the membranes and she just delivers. But for those, there are certain women who we know are at higher risk. For example, women who've previously had a preterm birth, women who are pregnant with twins or higher order multiple gestations, or if you have a medical complication like high blood pressure or diabetes.
Only 10% of babies born at 23 weeks survive, including one at your own hospital last year. But 70% of babies born at 24 weeks survive. Why such a big difference in the space of only a week?
So 23 to 24 weeks is what we call periviability. It really is at the margins of survival, and really small changes make a difference. A lot of it will depend on exactly how big that individual 23 or 24 week baby is and how strong they are, or what was the specific reason why they delivered. So for example, if a baby is born at 24 weeks because it's poorly growing and the mother had high blood pressure, that baby has less chance of survival than if the woman just went into labour with an otherwise healthy pregnancy.
The complications of being born early, do they persist into these babies' lives later?
Well, they certainly can do. Preterm birth and the complications of being born early are one of the most important causes of childhood morbidity. So, for example, preterm babies may have blindness. Preterm babies may have bleeding in the brain that can lead to cerebral palsy. But thankfully, the vast majority of babies born after 28 weeks will survive healthy with no long-term complications.
I mentioned at the start that the Rotunda is the busiest hospital in Europe. It's also very overcrowded. You went on Lifeline to talk recently about overcrowding after a dad went onto the programme to talk about changing his wife's sheets at the hospital after a fourth baby was born because staff were so busy. And you're quoted in this morning's Irish Times saying that overcrowding has led to the death of one baby and others suffering from meningitis.
So we know that there's a direct correlation between overcrowding, in particular in the neonatal intensive care unit, and infection control. If intensive care incubators are less than a metre apart, no matter how good the hand hygiene and infection control practices are in the hospital, it's almost impossible to prevent infection. The Rotunda has been lauded by HICWA for its hygiene standards, but there's nothing you can do about that if cots are so cramped together that you can't isolate and separate babies. So you need a minimum of 3 metres apart between incubators to provide safe care.
The long-term plan is to move the Rotunda to Blanchardstown, where you'll have an awful lot more space, and that was announced by the then Minister for Health, Leo Varadkar, in 2015. Where is that plan at now?
So while meetings have occurred to try and spec out exactly what the new Rotunda would look like on Connolly, there's been no meaningful advance in terms of actual development on the ground. The Rotunda put forward about 3 years ago a design plan for what the new Rotunda would look like on Connolly, but unfortunately Connolly as a hospital level doesn't have all of the critical care and intensive care facilities to receive Rotunda patients. So at the moment, if the Rotunda moved to Connolly tomorrow, we'd still actually have to move or transport our critically ill mothers back into the Mater if they got sick, because Connolly just doesn't have that sort of clinical infrastructure.
In the meantime, you want to expand at Parnell Square, yes?
In the meantime, I need to look after the patients we have today and for the next 10 years. In the next 10 years, Gavin, we will deliver over 90,000 women in Parnell Square on the Rotunda campus. That's an awful lot of clinical risk. So I do need to think about what is a safe way and the dignified way to care of those women. And that requires an infrastructure development on Parnell Square. And that can move ahead in parallel with plans for Connolly. But it is absolutely needed for today's safe care.
What's going to happen today at the hospital? Essentially a party to celebrate those who survived, yes?
This is a superb day in the calendar of the Rotunda. This is the graduation party for so many healthy survivors for premature maturity. These are parents who have given their all to see their babies get through a very, very tough journey. And while a small number of our babies tragically don't make it, so many do, and so many do with healthy babies. And to celebrate that, and to celebrate the contribution that these parents have made to the survival of their babies, a healthy survival of their babies, we throw a party every year on this World Prematurity Day.
Fergal Malone, Professor Fergal Malone, Master at the Rotunda Hospital, thank you very much for coming into us this morning.
36 towns and villages release untreated sewage into our water system every day. That's according to the Environmental Protection Agency. Half of it comes from three towns, Arklow in Wicklow, Kilmore Quay in Wexford and Cove in Cork. Andy Fanning is Programme Manager with the EPA's Office of Environmental Enforcement. You're welcome and good morning to you. It's not a new problem, unfortunately, but it's not one that's going away either.
Absolutely. I suppose the report that we published today on our urban wastewater treatment in 2018 shows there have been some improvements. So, for example, there have been two locations where raw sewage has ceased over the last year. Unfortunately, we still have 36 towns and villages which are discharging raw sewage into our environment every day. And I suppose we were expecting Irish Water to deliver a lot of the treatment. They had advised us that they were going to deliver treatment for all but five of those by the end of 2021. But now we're looking at slippages and delays, which mean we're looking at more than 13 at this point, which will not achieve that. And I suppose from an EPA perspective, the repeated delays in delivering this treatment is not acceptable.
What's going on then in these three towns in particular, where half of this is coming from, Arklow, Kilmore Quay and Cove? Are their wastewater treatment plants not working properly?
Let's be clear, it is raw sewage here, so there is no wastewater treatment plant in Arklow. I know that Irish Water has recently gotten plan permission for a new treatment plant, but it will take a number of years for them to get that in place. In Kilmore Quay, similarly, we did expect to see a treatment plant in place by the end of 2019. That has now been pushed out into 2022. So again, we're seeing these slippages in treatment plants for larger towns and villages, and I suppose we're expecting Irish Water to get themselves organised to prioritise and deliver on these treatment plants, because having raw sewage discharging into our rivers and into our seas is not acceptable in a modern age.
And what's happening in Cove?
In Cove, there is work ongoing at the moment. So parts, I suppose, Cork City and the environs of Cove are of particular importance. There is the two areas where raw sewage is no longer being discharged are Passage West and Ringaskiddy. So there is work going around Cork Harbour to connect those into the Shan Valley treatment plant. So we'll be watching that one, and that one we would expect to see in place more quickly than the others.
Okay, and I mean, it's dangerous, isn't it, for people's health for this to be happening?
Absolutely. Well, there's a number of risks here. One is raw sewage contains lots of bacteria, viruses and other nasties that you don't want getting into your drinking water supplies. But it also affects your bathing waters as well. So we have three locations, two of them here in Dublin, where you've got Sandymount and Merrion Strands, where the bathing water is not acceptable. We also have Clifton and Galway, where we haven't seen, the new treatment plant was put in by Irish Water there, but there were parts of the network which weren't getting treated, and that was still causing problems for the bathing water at Clifton.
And for those areas where this is a real issue, Is the drinking water safe to drink or not?
Oh, absolutely. So we have a separate process where we do monitor the how Irish Water are implementing their drinking water provisions. So we have a list of 64 locations. So I suppose in relation to urban wastewater, which is today, we have 120 priorities to look at. On the drinking water side, there's 64, and we have timelines for delivery of infrastructure to deal with those from Irish Water, and the plans are set. I suppose in relation to the 120 urban wastewater ones that we're looking at today, we still have 22 of those which we have not got specific plans from Irish Water how they're going to deal with them. And they are ones where it's actually causing pollution of our rivers and our lakes. So from an EPA perspective, we've prioritised 120, which is only around about 10% of the treatment plants in the country. We've told Irish Water, focus on these, deliver the treatment that's required, prevent the pollution and protect public health.
I want to ask you about the leak slip water treatment plant, because the boiled water notice, which was affecting 615,000 people, was lifted yesterday evening. Are you confident that it is now 100% safe for people in those areas to drink their water from the tap?
Yeah, the water from that plant is safe to drink at this point. Right. Now, the EPA did audit this last Friday, And I suppose what we've said is that the ability of Leakslip to maintain that level of performance is a concern to ourselves. We've required them to do daily monitoring for parasites. So these are the Cryptosporidium and Giardia that you might have heard of in the past. And they are going to be reporting back to us in relation to that. We've also set very stringent standards on what their filtration system will have to deliver. And if that starts tending upwards, as happened in the last event, in the last incident, they have to immediately notify ourselves, immediately notify HSC, and we'll then engage with them to see whether any other further action is required.
You say it's safe to drink, but Dr. Tom Ryan from the EPA was before the Oireachtas Housing Committee last week, and he said in relation to Cryptosporidium and Giardia that there was currently a deficit of treatment for those very serious parasites, and even the filter upgrade works that Irish Water were engaged in were not sufficient for combating these parasites. So how is the water safe to drink?
Well, the water is safe to drink because of the level of treatment that's been achieved, and we've set a very, very tight limit on the turbidity that can come out of that plant. So that gives us that level of protection. Now, there is a treatment deficit at Leakslip, and the upgrade of their filtration systems, which is ongoing at the moment, will achieve a much higher level of treatment than we currently have. But in our audit, we have asked them to come back to us by 30th of November, asking us how they will deal with the residual deficit that is there. We have suggested and recommended that they would consider UV treatment there. UV disinfection. So we would expect within the next couple of weeks to get that response from them, and we will evaluate that to determine whether we need to.
I asked the Managing Director of Irish Water last Friday about this, and he said that they had done a feasibility study, as you asked, in relation to the UV disinfection, but it might be another year before that's added.
Absolutely, and that's why that very, very tight limit on the turbidity in the water leaving the plant has to be adhered to.
Could they do it quicker than that, though, in your view?
I think it will take them that sort of period of time. I think the priority at the moment is to deal with the upgrade of the filtration system. Now, Irish Water have throttled back the amount of water coming out of that plant so they can achieve a much higher level of process control. So we're monitoring it very closely. They're not producing as much water as they were previously, but I think it is something that we will be monitoring vigilantly over the next couple of months.
Okay, well, good luck. Thank you very much, Andy Fanning from the Environmental Protection Agency.
Income from corporation tax is likely to be higher than expected this year. That's what the Finance Minister, Pascal Donoghue, told an Oireachtas committee yesterday as he outlined the latest budgetary position. Now, you'll remember that the budget for next year was based around something that didn't happen, an immediate disorderly Brexit. However, the Minister told the Oversight Committee that he'd no plans to revisit his calculations. And Pascal Donoghue is with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
You based the budget on the likelihood of Britain crashing out of the EU at the end of October. That didn't happen, so why not revisit your plans?
Because while it is clear that a no-deal Brexit will not be happening in 2019, it's by no means clear to me what is likely to happen in 2020. And I won't be able to categorically confirm that we are avoiding a no-deal until two things happen. First, I see the passage of the withdrawal agreement through the House of Commons. And second, we see agreement on a transition period that allows the UK to move into a stable long-term relationship with the European Union.
That would be fine, wouldn't it, if nobody was losing out? But the Economic and Social Research Institute calculated that the budget will have the most negative impact on the poorest households. So why not take the opportunity to put that right?
If you look at all the different budgets that I have done, I have prioritised the needs of low-income households by regular increases in social welfare payments that matter to them.
That wasn't the case with this one, though.
But what we did do in this particular budget then is we made some very targeted changes to support families that are really at risk and high risk of poverty. But the ESRI model does not take account of improvements in services and the services that we have in place to support families and citizens who face that kind of risk.
So you're ruling out any change?
I will not be doing another budget next year. We will have, between April and May, a number of opportunities to review where the economy and our society stands, and I will not be bringing in another budget across that period.
You spoke yesterday of the distinct possibility of higher corporation tax receipts. What information do you have to suggest that?
All of my experience in this issue, which feeds into why I believe it's the right thing to continue to be careful with our budgets and how we manage our expenditure. If you look at where we are this year, we expect to collect in excess of 11 billion euro in corporation tax receipts. That will be around 19 to 20% of all the tax that we collect in our country.
Is that too high, though?
Well, actually, I expect to see it grow again. But what I indicated yesterday is that I think there are many reasons that lead me to believe that that rate of increase will plateau, will stabilise and then will fall. This is a risk, this is a change that if we plan for now, we will be able to deal with. And it's why I believe that given that we're going to deliver a budgetary surplus for this year, we need to continue to build them. So if this money lowers at a point in the future, we're able to avoid cutbacks in services and increase in taxes.
What's going to happen then to the extra money you take in this year? What are you going to do with it?
There are two things that will happen with that money. The first one, if you look at some additional money that will be needed to fund improved public services, some of that money will be used to fund the changes that we need to make to fund better services within the year.
Does that mean it'll go into the Department of Health?
Well, this has been a subject of criticism in the past, as you know. But the key thing is the degree of overspends that we have for this year are significantly lower than they have been in previous years.
Yet there are still overspends.
And what I indicated in my Budget Day speech and on a number of occasions since then is that level of overspend needs to come down further, and I am accounting for all of that in my Budget 2020 plans. The other thing that will happen, as I indicated yesterday in the Dáil, is we will deliver a surplus for this year. And I expect, and will be in a position to confirm this in early December, that our surplus will increase, which is a result of collecting more taxes, but also significantly improving where we are with the management of public expenditure versus a year ago.
Yesterday, the central bank said that the banks here were continuing to resist doing the right thing. What's your response?
I support the views of the Central Bank of Ireland.
Can you do more than that?
I continue to put a lot of focus on how we can drive change. We need good people running our banks in a strong and clear way. I believe there is some signs of change, but we need to see more change.
Really? Because the central bank says that the mortgage rate being charged to many people is twice what it needs to be.
Which is why, as I said, we need to see more change. To go back to your earlier question about what I am doing to try and drive this change forward, I'm currently in the process of drafting and then bringing in new laws that will ensure that responsibility and how we measure and then sanction the lack of responsibility is better able to be regulated for individuals within banks as opposed to banks overall. I have set up an independent cultural board to look at the culture within Irish banks. And what we then need to see is two things happen. We need to see the level of non-performing loans in our country continue to fall. And in parallel to that, banks need to continue with their work to ensure they're cost efficient and able over time to deliver the right mortgage rates for our country.
So
and
you, in particular, you do want them to bring down those rates?
I've said this on a number of occasions, and in particular the practice that Mr. Sibley highlighted yesterday, where we see one mortgage rate available to new customers and a different mortgage rate to existing customers, that needs to converge.
Can I ask you about Noel Grealish's comments yesterday about money leaving the country in remittances? He asked whether some of this could be the proceeds of crime, and he specifically raised money going to Nigeria. He's quoted a figure of 3.4 billion over 8 years. Is that figure accurate?
Well, I'm sure he'll be bringing forward the figures to justify that across the day. The figures that are available to me from the Central Statistics Office are some way short of this. It is difficult to accurately estimate this, but it can be modelled. And the Central Statistics Office indicate that across many years, that figure has been around 17 million euro per year.
There's a massive difference between 17 million a year and the figure quoted by Noel Grealish, isn't there?
And this is why it's important for Deputy Grealish to make clear exactly where these figures are coming from. And also,
he says they're coming from the World Bank.
Well, also, and I believe to make clear why he is signalling out a particular country outside the European Union.
Why do
reference.
You believe he's doing that?
That's up to Mr. Deputy Grealish to justify himself. I'm really clear that the change that we've seen happen in our society over many years now, where we've had people come to Ireland, look to make it their home, has been very positive for our society. and will be very, very positive for our economy in the future as well. And as the Taoiseach said yesterday, remittances were a really important part of our economy for a long time. We have to acknowledge they're an important part of other economies today.
But the thing is, Noel Grealish mostly supports the government. You might find yourselves relying on him at any time. Just a few weeks ago, he used the word sponging in connection with Africans. Shouldn't somebody from the government have a word with him?
Well, I'm happy to say now that, and I think this has been made clear yesterday by the Taoiseach when he looked to challenge what was the intention behind this kind of language, that anything at all that looks to stir up a particular kind of debate in relation to those who have arrived in our country over many years is something that I recoil from. We can have a debate. It needs to be a debate that's based on facts. It needs to be a debate that's based on respect. We need to also acknowledge that we have very clear laws in place here in Ireland that look at the issue of remittances and behaviour and flows of money that could be in any way suspicious.
Are you satisfied then that nothing suspicious has been happening?
I'm certainly not aware that there are flows of funding from Ireland to any country that is a cause for criminal investigation at the moment. And this is why I think Deputy Grealish should clarify why he's signalling a particular country and why he feels this is a cause for suspicion.
It seems that the figure you quoted, this figure of an average of 17 million a year going to Nigeria, and that contrasts, it should be said, with in 2017, 342 million going back to Poland, 92 million to Lithuania, 43 million to India, 50 to Latvia. It seems that these figures were provided to Noel Grealish. Why do you think then that he used the other figure yesterday?
It's up to him to clarify his intentions and up to him to clarify his use of figures. I'm very happy to clarify my view on these issues here, which is that there's been much change in our economy, much change in our society as a result of people from elsewhere in Europe and outside of Europe coming to our country. It's the kind of experience that Ireland visited to many other countries at other points in our history. We should have a degree of generosity and a focus on the facts when we are debating this.
Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Finance. Thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland. Lisa Smith, the County Louth woman who travelled to Syria to join the so-called Islamic State, is likely to be back in Ireland within the next few weeks. A spokesperson for the Turkish government said two Irish people were among a group of 20 it's preparing to deport. RTE News understands that he was referring to Ms. Smith and her two-year-old daughter. With us is security consultant Michael Murphy, who was formerly an intelligence officer with the Defence Forces. Good morning.
Morning, Lisa.
Over the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of speculation as to Lisa Smith's whereabouts. It now seems that she was captured by the Turkish authorities.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what happens to her next?
Well, I believe the story is that she is to be escorted home and to arrive here, and originally the guards are said that they will hold her and then interview her and to see where they might go from there.
Mm-hmm. She's not alone. Turkey seems to be holding citizens of a number of other EU countries.
That's right. There's over 2,000 of them that have been captured so far from all over Europe, and they have to be returned. Well, Turkey can't hold them. And if they stay in Iraq and Syria, then obviously they'll only be adding to the jihadi problem that's there, because ISIS has not gone away. ISIS is still very active. ISIS is growing still in Europe and in that area, and certainly in Africa. So therefore, there's a fear that these jihadis may resurrect on the ground in Syria and in Iraq.
Gardaí described Lisa Smith as a person of interest. What's likely to happen to her if and when she does return to this country?
Well, one of the big problems here is that we don't have a law that we should have put in place back in 2014 and 15 by the government that would have made it an offence to have just travelled to the ISIS territory itself. And therefore, it would have been easy to convict somebody for having given material support to a terrorist organisation by doing so. And of course, NGOs and media people could have gone there with a visa from the government. So that isn't restricting people from travelling there, except that you have to have permission. If that was the case, she could now be coming back and facing 10 years jail. But unfortunately, that is not the case. So she comes back, the Gardaí might hold her, unless there is some incriminating evidence As they don't have intelligence themselves in Syria and what she was doing in Syria. So therefore, where are they going to get the evidence to convict her of anything?
Mm-hmm. Could they use the intelligence of others, say the intelligence of the Turkish authorities?
Well, that would have to go into the court, of course, but what, under what charge? And like the main thing that women were doing for ISIS was giving support to the men, producing babies for further jihadis, disciplining other women, recruiting women, and committing suicide bombing. So how can they, that is mainly what they were, that the women were involved in, so how would they be able to convict on any evidence in those cases?
Is it likely, though, that she will be under surveillance here?
Well, you know, this is one of the problems I've been mentioning. We've had the Taoiseach and the Minister for Defence and Justice and Foreign Affairs talking about doing a security threat analysis. It's like a tick box exercise. It isn't. A threat analysis has to come up with a result. And if somebody has gone voluntarily to ISIS, then obviously it's more than likely that there is a security threat still existing until proven otherwise. So therefore, that person should be kept under surveillance. That involves, and most people don't realise this, and I'm trying to get it across, that's at least 32 people per day keeping that person under surveillance.
32 people? How do you get to that figure?
Because every move that person makes, who they talk to, what messages they're passing on, and it costs about $1 million per annum per person under surveillance. It's nearly impossible to do, and so therefore, this is how you had in a number of cases in Europe, where you had jihadis who were kept under surveillance, and lost for a few minutes, and that's when they went and did, the contact with other people.
So what, in your view, then, could the government have done differently?
Well, the main thing they should have done, and they were advised to do it, and that was to bring in a law to make an offence, and anybody coming back from ISIS territory should now be facing a mandatory 10-year sentence. We're now in a situation where we have at least one person coming home. There are others. What do we do then? And can we keep these people under surveillance like that? We didn't do very well in relation to the security of the businessmen over in Cavan. So why should it be any different in relation to this? We're not taking this seriously, and we should be doing a bit better.
Isn't one of the complications here, I mean, if you listen to the interviews that Lisa Smith has done, she's not an immediately sympathetic person, but she does have a 2-year-old daughter mm-hmm. who is in that part of the world yes. through no fault of her own, and no doubt has family here mm-hmm. who would love to see her.
Yes, but there are. I always look, and when we talk about compassion, I think of the compassion of the victims of terrorism, whose legs are blown apart, whose hands are blown apart, whose faces are deformed. That's compassion without wisdom is naivety. And we have to be very careful. Of course the child is a 2-year-old is absolutely innocent. But you just can't use the word compassion and say, oh, well, that's fine.
Michael Murphy, thank you very much for joining us on Morning Ireland. For Liverpool fans, it was a great win, 3-1 against Man City yesterday. There was one very special fan at Anfield. Sean Cox was there. The Meath man was left with life-changing injuries following a brutal assault close to Anfield before a Champions League match against Roma in 2018. It was his first time back at Anfield since that attack. Well, Stephen Fell is chairman of the Sean Cox Trust and a family friend. Stephen, that must have been an emotional day for all the family yesterday.
Yeah, it was a hugely emotional day, not just for Sean, but for his wife Martina and his 3 children who were with him for the whole match before and after.
So what happened? He went backstage, as it were, and he met the manager and the team?
Yeah, Sean, it was a pretty momentous return visit to Anfield. He met the manager in terms of Jurgen Klopp straight after the game. He met a number of the team, including Virgil van Dijk. And over the course of the day, a lot of the Liverpool legends who were in attendance in the stadium dropped by to meet Sean. So people like Ian Rush, Phil Thompson and John Bishop, the comedian, who's become a friend and supporter of the family, all dropped by to have their pictures taken with Sean.
It has been so impressive, I thought. No matter what you might think of Liverpool on the pitch, they have their critics, let's put it like that, but no one can dispute how they have been since this assault on Sean and how they have just taken him into their embrace.
Yeah, it's cliched to hear Liverpool talk about being more than a club and being a family, but in Sean's case, it really has been the experience that Martina and the Cox family have felt. And it's, you know, the planning that went into yesterday by the club, and the, you know, the dignity which they left the family with. Like, while Sean was there and it was a big occasion for the family and for the club, it was also a personal and deeply emotional day for the Coxes, and Liverpool treated that very sensitively and were very respectful of what a big step it was for Sean and for the family.
How is he, Stephen?
He's improving. It's very small degrees. He's in a specialist centre in Sheffield, where he's been for the last 2 months and will be until the end of the year, and that's really focused on speech and generating some movement in the left side of his body, which is really, for all intents and purposes, paralysed. So Sheffield has been it's been great for Sean in terms of it's very intensive. Martina is over there with him. She's taken a flat close by the centre and spends all day with him. But it's very small degrees, and you know, as will have emerged from some of the pictures that are on social media from yesterday, it's clear that Sean is deeply dependent and has a very, very long journey ahead of him.
Well, please send him and his family our very best wishes. Thank you very much, Stephen Fell, who is a family friend and chairman of the Sean Cox Trust.